podcast of CBS This Morning will begin after this short break.
This episode of the CBS This Morning podcast is brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
The all-new 2018 Toyota Camry is about the furthest thing from a Camry you can imagine.
Get ready to love it for all the wrong reasons.
Love Lesson 23, How to Park Far, Far Away.
I can't see you, baby.
With its sculpted rocker panels, available integrated rear spoiler, and 19-inch alloy wheels, you're going to want to keep your Camry looking showroom fine. So pass all those close-in spaces and drive to your times on the way.
Door dings bad, exercise good.
The all-new 2018 Toyota Camry. You're going to love it.
For all the wrong reasons, baby.
Toyota, let's go places.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
I'm John Dickerson.
Yep, he is. I'm Gail King, and this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Welcome to the CBS This Morning podcast. I'm Vladimir Dutia, CBS News correspondent. Really excited because it's been 25 years since Mr. Jones became the Counting Crows' debut hit song. And joining me to reflect on the past 25 years and to look forward to the next 25 is Counting Crows frontman and lead singer Adam Duritz. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, man. First of all, I know you probably hear this, but August and Everything After was like on heavy rotation on my DVD player, on my CD player back in the day. I listened to it. I still probably put The Rain King on mix. Like people still, I still make mixtapes, although now they're on Spotify, but I still put that song on there because it's probably one of my favorite songs. So it's really cool to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
So since your first studio album, August and Everything, came out in 1993, you've released 7 studio albums, and you're embarking on this 2018 worldwide 25 years and counting tour this June. So tell me, what's it been like being part of Counting Crows and the ups and downs that you've experienced over these past 25 years?
Well, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, you try to kill the thing. I don't know. You know, it's weird because we live every day of it, and we've been pretty steadily touring and recording the entire time. It was weird to think of it as going by. It just doesn't seem like all that long, although I guess it's been half my life, really.
Right. And I mean, very few bands even can stick together after one album, especially when you look back at the time that we're talking about. So it's essentially my generation, your generation, the 90s. I'd just gotten out of college, and I was being turned on to all these new bands, all these new sounds that were coming out. And, you know, there's still some bands from that era that are around and together, but a lot of them are not. And I wonder if there's what did you discover being in this band for this amount of time that has allowed you to sort of continue to prosper after many of your like compatriots and other bands and other groups have fallen by the wayside?
Well, I really like being in a band. And I think I realized early on, and I mean, right at the beginning, how important it was to me. And so I always sort of made that a priority. You know, there's a lot of ways to screw up a band, you know, and there's a lot of ways for everybody to do the math where, I mean, you can always do the math and figure out that you deserve more. Anybody in any situation can. But you kind of got to make, you know, a list of your priorities and figure out what's really important to you. And I think I realized, you know, before we even got signed, how important being in a band was to me. And I think everything I've done since then has been about keeping that whole thing together. Mm. You know, you make all the decisions, you know, if you figure out what's really important to you, then all you have to do is make all your decisions with that in mind, you know, and as opposed to like, how much money can I, it doesn't really matter how much money you deserve if you want to figure it out that way, if you don't have enough left for everybody else and you don't have a band.
Right.
You know, there's a million ways. That's just one way to screw it up. But, you know, I think I just had that priority pretty straight from the beginning. I've never really wanted to be a solo artist. It doesn't interest me. I like the jazz of playing with other people. I like the interaction. I like the collaboration. I really like the jazz of being on stage and improvising with people. All those things are more band things than they are solo things. And You know, I understand why people do the solo thing, but I've never really wanted it. So I always did things to keep everybody okay and happy. I kind of thought that was my responsibility since I got to be in charge and tell everybody what to do. Kind of like it's your responsibility to take care of everybody in that case too.
That's really interesting. I mean, a lot of artists, very oftentimes you hear artists saying, you know, I don't have a responsibility to anybody or to anything other than either. I mean, generally what they'll say is my art, but what they really mean is, you know, oftentimes my ego or, you know, what I think is right for me and for the music that I'm producing. And you seem to have sort of an interesting take on that, which is that you kind of recognize that you want not just your fans, I guess, but like the people that you're working with, the people that you're on stage with to also feel comfortable.
Well, I mean, I also recognize that I think I would probably say that same thing, that there's nothing more important to me than the art. But I also recognize that my art is served by the collaboration with these guys, you know, and that this is the best place for me to make it, make that art, you know, and I don't think there's a better situation for me out there. So, you know, part of taking care of everybody else is taking care of myself and taking care of the art, because, you know, they're a big part of that. I mean, we've been working together and collaborating, and they've been somehow figuring out how to understand how to express the things that are in my head. They've been doing that for 25, 30 years now. Mm. You know, they're good at that, and they've made it a priority in their life to do that. So it seems, you know, it's not like it's just me sacrificing there. I mean, we're all working together in a really good way. It's just, you know, we've found the ways to prioritize that without screwing each other over. Not that we don't fight about
that. Sure. Things. I mean, you're human beings.
I'm definitely a tyrant about a lot of things. You know, you can screw around with a lot, but don't screw around with the music, you know, and, you know, I can be real harsh about that, but it's about that. And it's not about like me dominating another person, really, you know. Yeah. It's I don't want people screwing around with that stuff.
Yeah,
but they're good about that, you know, and we're, you know,
that's cool.
It's like family now, I guess.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's what I think people want to hear. I mean, and so how do you keep it fresh and exciting?
Well, we play a different set list every night. We just kind of figure out that afternoon, evening, what we want to play. Me and Emmer make a set list. Sometimes we ask for suggestions from everybody. But, you know, one thing we do is we don't play songs we don't feel like playing that day. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing's so sacred that it has to be played every day. Some songs seem to get in there every day. I never get tired of a long December. So it's almost always in the set.
Yeah.
But there's almost nothing else that's so completely glued in there. Probably Palisades Park has been for the last couple mm-hmm, years mm-hmm. since we wrote it. But, you know, everything else comes in and out depending on how you feel that day. Because I don't want to start hating my songs. And the surest way to do that, if you know you're going to be doing something every night for 30 years, is to do things every night you don't want to do. Right. That's a pretty good way to start disliking it.
So what can people expect on this tour? Give us a little bit of a... of an insight. I mean, I already like the fact that you know, that set changes every night and that you guys sort of kind of know what you want to do and what you don't want to do. That's kind of cool.
Well, I think they can expect a truly passionate show from people who are completely into what they're doing, and a set of nightly disappointments as well, probably.
Because why do you say that?
Well, because we've got a lot of songs and we're not playing every song every night. And because for me, you know, when we make a record, it's, you know, 10, 12 things I love. And one of them gets picked by the record company at some point to be a single, often with us just because it's the shortest song.
Mm-hmm.
I love those songs, but I don't love them any more than the other songs. So if I have 100+ songs to choose from, which I do, and we have about 80 in rotation at any given time, which is a lot, but you're probably not going to hear something you really wanted to hear that night.
Right.
I mean, this just seems likely, you know?
Yeah.
We're not putting as much of a premium on whether they were singles or not. we're just playing songs we like on a given night, and which definitely includes the singles, but not all of them and not every night. And we do stuff from every record, which means if there's one record you love, like I said, there's a nightly disappointment quotient for sure.
How often does the Rain King make it in?
That makes it in a lot because it's a great encore song.
Is it really? Is that how you guys play it? That's awesome.
That's usually in the encore, and that actually makes it in. That's one of the ones that's pretty often in there too, because it's just such a great encore song. The encore has been pretty set for a while. Usually it's been Palisades Park and then Rain King, and then often Holiday in Spain.
Nice.
That trio has been in there for a while, and it's just, I kind of love it. So that's in there a lot. I mean, sometimes because we improvise a lot on stage, you can't really be sure of the length of songs. And so that, you know, we can screw up the timing of a set and end up with less time at the end of the night and something gets cut. But it's rarely Rain King. That just works really well.
That's cool. I mean, look, that song turned me on to Sawbello. I mean, even though it was probably assigned reading in high school, which, you know, I barely recall my high school days. But when I read somewhere that that's where the inspiration from the song for the song came, I was like, let me check this out, you know, and the song and then just reading the book sort of inspired me in a bunch of ways. So I wonder, where do you turn for inspiration? Like now, I mean, do you still look at books? Do you still like take, I mean, for example, you're from Baltimore. I wonder if the things that we saw over the last couple of years in Baltimore, for example, with Freddie Gray, if that's affected you in any way, if that seeps into the music.
Well, I left there really early. I mean, I left there at 3. It's where my grandmother lived.
Yeah, it's real early.
So it's the place I went back to visit my grandmother, but I didn't really have that much. You know, when you're going to visit your grandmother, you're a kid, you're in her apartment. I didn't really have a connection to the city or the locale. I mean, I loved the O's growing up. But for me, the places that I really have an attachment to from, you know, my childhood are, you know, Texas and California. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, West Texas and El Paso and then Oakland and Berkeley. That's really where I grew up. To me, those places have been a big part of my writing. And then Los Angeles and New York too. As far as like, you know, songs are about lots of things too, but sure. I can see tons from those places in the songs. Not as much, you know, even, I mean, I've always just kind of written about yesterday and today. I've always just written about my life. Even Rain King, I mean, I read the book in college and it was it had a big effect on me. But that song, I remember the night I wrote that song, it was years later. And I actually was sitting by myself at home watching Dr. Zhivago, the David Lean movie.
Oh, yeah, I love that film, dude. That's awesome.
And it was over and it just really moved me. And it's just whatever moves me. It moved me, and I got up and went into the other room and wrote Rain King.
That's so great.
That was one of the things that influenced it. And the other thing was that I had been messing around. You know, I'm not really trained as a musician. I kind of taught myself to play, and I don't play very well. You know, I have to really work at things. And I had been listening to The Cure, and I had been listening to Boys Don't Cry, and I was trying to figure out how the chord pattern worked on that song.
Right.
And when I figured it out, you know, that it's shifting between two chords in the right hand, and either ascending or descending in the left, I can't remember which one. I thought that was a cool sound where you just move this ascending or descending line through two chords. And I flipped it upside down. Like whatever it was, ascending or descending, I reversed it. And whatever the chords were, I think I reversed them to see what that would sound like. And that's the verse of Rain King. I had been doing that early in the day. And then I watched Dr. Zhivago, and I wrote Rain King in 40 minutes after that movie. You know, it was a mixture of an experiment with David Lean and Robert Smith somehow contributed to Rain King, even though it doesn't sound like either thing to me.
Yeah, no, it's its own thing for sure. And that's, I think, what makes it so cool. I mean, even with all those little pieces of inspiration coming to you, it's just one of those songs that, you know, it's just from the moment I heard it to today, it has. And that's what music sort of does, I think, for people. It just sort of takes you back or gives you some sense of being that you know, enjoy going to every time. And I think that's a good thing. And so I'm excited for you guys. And I'm sure the fans are going to be excited too of this tour, the 2018 Worldwide 25 Years and Counting Tour. It begins this June. We're so excited to you stop by, to talk to us on CBS This Morning. Adam Duritz, thank you very much.
thanks for having me. We're really looking forward to this. It'll be nice to see live again. And I'm looking forward to Boom Forest opening the show. I love that band, too.
Boom Forest opening the show. This is so cool. Thank you very much, Adam. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
And you have a podcast.
Yeah. You know, my friend James Campion, he writes for the Aquarian Weekly, and he had been interviewing me for years. And a couple years ago, he said, you know, we have so much material in these interviews. This could be a great book. And so about a year and a half ago, we started meeting every week for about 4 or 5 hours and just talking through stuff. And then I got home one day, like 3 or 4 months ago, and said, you know, this would also make a really cool podcast. And so we just started doing it, like sitting around and talking about music and playing music. And it's been great. You know, we didn't do any press for it at all because I just wanted to give us time to get better at it. But we're putting out our 10th show this coming Tuesday. And it's really cool. We put them out every Tuesday, and it's called Underwater Sunshine. And it's just two geeks talking about music.
Awesome. All right. Underwater Sunshine every Tuesday. This is the CBS This Morning podcast. My name is Vladimir Dutte, and you've been listening to me having a chat with Adam Duritz of Counting Crows. They're going on a new tour, 25 years and counting. Starts this June. Check it out.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.